Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mo. We're back in a morning meeting after a couple of evening sessions. As you had been on the road, I had been on the road. Yep. Now yep. We're back, and so I've already had cup number one in the Ortho Joe mug. You got yours, George.
I got mine.
This is going to be your very special reward for allowing us to interview for the Ortho Joe. It's priceless. Is what it is. This mug.
I can't wait. I will look forward to it. I will sip with pride.
So this morning, Mo and I have a special guest to interview, Dr. George Dyer from the Brigham and Women's, a world famous hand and upper extremity surgeon who also served as the residency director there for a decade. Do I have that right, George?
That's right. It was 10 years.
At the Harvard Combined Residency. And George has been the deputy editor for the AOA Educational Channel on JBJS Open Access. And it's something that we started, nearly 2 years ago, a channel in Open Access to get all of the educational research content in one spot, free to the world, accessible to anybody around the world, as we try to improve the way that we educate our residents to care for people. And I would also say that George has a career-long interest in developing world orthopedic surgery. I've been to Haiti with George several times, and George has traveled the world trying to help improve the skills of our colleagues around the world. And George, thanks so much for willing to be interviewed, and thanks for taking this job on. You've done a great job. Maybe I'll start out. I know Mo always has better questions than I, but I'm going to go first. So why did you ever become a residency director? And that's question one. And question two, what's the biggest thing you learned in that role?
So I could give you the joke answer, you know, because people like to be sort of all shucks and humble, and also pretend to whine about the job of being a program director. Because it's, of course, it's not all roses.
No, indeed.
There's plenty of thorns. But it was really a unique and wonderful opportunity, and I just felt really fortunate to have gotten it at a fairly young stage in my career. Actually, I was only in my mid-40s when I started to do that, and at Harvard anyway, the residency director has mostly been sort of a swan song job. So my predecessors were just these towering figures, Jim Herndon and Dempsey Springfield and Henry Mankin, and those were my three direct immediate predecessors. So it was really quite an honor to be asked to do that job, and I just tried to bring some different energy to it, the energy not of a very senior person, but of somebody a little more junior. Mm-hmm. This is a time when residency education is very much in transition, and what is required of residents has changed a lot over my relatively short career. In 15 years, it's changed a great deal. Educational methods have changed, and I think it's just been a joy to be in the middle of all of that. And so when I had the chance, I jumped at it.
Right. And the second question, what's the biggest thing you learned in the role?
Two things. One is really about the job and about education. The other is about myself, if I may. What I learned about residents is that there is a sort of a cultural divide, probably, as the 80-hour work week and kind of learning changes and millennials have come through. I think a lot has been made, really too much has been made, about the differences between millennial learners and older residents. And the main thing I've learned is that orthopedic trainees are just as smart and eager and hardworking as they ever were, you know. And so I say to the older surgeons who kind of look down their nose and say, oh, when I was, you know, when I was in your shoes, we walked uphill both ways. I just think, you know, probably since cavemen were looking around and saying, kids these days, you know, all they want to do is scribble on the walls. Like, why can't they go outside and get chased by tigers like we did? You know, I feel like that's just part of a human condition, is that you think you had it harder than those who are coming along behind you. Yeah. So that's one thing I've learned. And I just want to repeat that message, really, of a confidence in today's learners for their work ethic and their eagerness to be great. What I learned about myself is that the job of running a big, complicated residency is just harder than you'd think. Mm-hmm. It's not a big surprise, but the number of little problems and big problems that you face are just more than you'd imagine. But the little joys of it are more than you expect. And so it was a nice run, and happy to leave on a pretty high note after 10 years and move on to the next adventure.
So George, there's many things you've said that already like sort of resonate with me tremendously on a personal note. But no, the thing that I have been particularly interested and invested in is, you know, the concept of residency training 10, 15 years ago versus now. There is definitely safeguards put in place for resident well-being, resident mental health. You know, certainly the last 2 years has certainly changed a lot for all of us and made us think on a big level. My younger self used to always tell, you know, our trainees, and I'd have graduate students, and I'd always say, you know, we have to go big or go home. We've got to, you know, used to use that strategy all the time. You know, you've got to think big. You've got to put in the time, and nothing happens without the hard work. And I remember one particular trainee coming to me and saying, and he said, you know, we're pretty familiar with her. He says, you know, Mo, when you keep telling our residents to go big or go home, you grossly underestimate our desire to go home. And that's it. And I said to myself, that's interesting. And then I realized it took me 10 years to figure out I'm wrong. And they were right, quite frankly, which is the argument wasn't that, oh, we're not interested in, you know, spending the time and hours. It's how we spend our time and how we spend our hours is very, very important. And so toiling away for hundreds of hours doesn't necessarily, you know, the classic example of someone who looks busy isn't actually productive. That, I think, has been the biggest revelation for me. And I wonder for you during residency training as a program director, that has been, it sounds like some of that has been the evolution of, I think, many programs around the world. And I think many trainees are actually, in some cases, probably better off, and not just in terms of life balance, but in terms of their ability to innovate because they have time to do so.
I hope that's true. I love that idea. I hope that's true. I fear, though, that part of what's gone wrong in residency training, at least at our place, and it may be different other places, is that the residents are very task saturated, but actually not very well occupied. They're busy, but they're not challenged. And a lot of what they do is just sort of, you know, they're feeding databases and they're completing things in EMRs and they're calling to coordinate care for patients after routine discharges. And I mean, all this is work that somebody has to do. A lot of it is, I'm not going to say it's unimportant, but it's certainly new from when we all trained. Mm-hmm. You know, discharging a patient when I was a resident took like a few minutes, really. Yeah. You picked up the phone and you quickly blurted a summary of the patient's course and you wrote on the paper chart, discharged to home, and they were out. Yeah. Now that takes half a day. Mm-hmm. And that act of admitting a patient or discharging a patient is far more frequent. You know, when I was a resident, a routine total hip was stayed in the hospital for 5 days. That was the pathway. There was something they called the advanced pathway where they stayed for only 3 days. You know, now that's overnight or day surgery. And so all of the takeoffs and landings, which is really what occupies a house officer's time, is a much greater percentage of what you do. And so although, you know, training in the pre-work hours era, I was in the hospital for days and days. Much of that time wasn't that it was unoccupied, but I could read, I could do research projects, I could hang out with more senior residents and with faculty and just sort of talk and learn orthopedics in a kind of a casual way. Now, every minute that a resident is in the hospital is just sucked into a task. And so, although I partly agree that limiting those hours is essential so you can just go do something else outside, it seems to me that there used to be a softer boundary between work and free thinking inside the hospital, actually.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot from senior residents and my peers, because we weren't all like facing a computer away from each other the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you had to re-envision on that note, George, if you had to re-envision what residency training could look like, how would you quote, I use the term fix, but I'm not sure, you know, it has to be fixed per se, but maybe re-envisioned.
Well, I wish we were a little clearer about what is the essential work of education and what is just work. The job of a resident has always existed a little uneasily between two worlds. It's both a job and it's also education. We know it's not purely education because for that you pay tuition, right? And you get paid a salary to be a resident. So everybody comes to residency expecting to work. But some of that work is definitely educational. So assisting in surgery, that's no one would say that's not educational for a surgeon. But typing on a computer and instead of going to the OR, not so educational. And so I would like to see a clearer delineation between what's really moving somebody's education forward and what's not. And I fear that the resident is uncomplaining mostly. And I know as a program director, that sounds like to other program directors will say, my residents are not uncomplaining. But in the scheme of things, they are uncomplaining. You know, who else will take call on holidays and stay till the work is done and come in at 3 a.m? Like there's nobody else in the hospital who just does that basically without complaining. And so it's very easy for that workforce to absorb more and more tasks, and I think they've been taken advantage of in some ways.
So George, at some training programs, there has been a shift of that work to other members of the team who aren't physicians, and residents just simply text that individual and say, "Mr. Jones in 14 needs to be seen in the clinic in 2 days. At that time, the staple should be taken out and discharged on this medication." And some other member of the team does that. What are the barriers, do you think, in your institution to offloading that work and giving greater time for the educational part?
I think there's two, I'm going to answer that in two parts. The first part is, may surprise you, which is I think some of that is actually important to do. Some of it is not just work, but the big barrier is money. You know, the amount of hours, even in the restricted work hours rules that residents labor under now, the number of hours they work and the value of their labor, if you pay them at the rate of a physician assistant or a nurse practitioner, is just prohibitive.
Yeah,
it just costs too much to replace all of that work with some other kind of professional labor. On the flip side, I'm not advocating that residents should do no work. You know, like it's not school, and not only is it important to do work because you're getting paid for a job, but at least at our place, and this is, I think, true nationally for sure, only about 20% of graduates of academic residencies stay in academics. 80% of my graduates go into private practices where they are like, there's not an army of nurse practitioners in your little hospital. Odds are you're rounding on your own patients. You're recognizing complications on post-op day one on your own. You're discharging them on your own. Now, maybe it's a little less cumbersome than in an academic medical center, but those are skills you actually need to have. And so it's not that they have no educational value, but I think the balance is off at the moment.
Yeah. George, if I could, I know I've already proven on this particular interview that Mo asked the better questions, but if I could have another one with. So you were interested in becoming the editor of the Education Channel in collaboration with the AOA on JBJSOA. Why were you interested in, and what are your dreams and visions for this publication?
Oh, it's great. I mean, so what? Why? I'm not just trying to butter you up, Mark, but in part it was to work with you and the other people who I really respect at JBJS. I wanted to see what the inside of publishing at the highest academic level was like. And it's been no disappointment. It's been great. I also love sitting like right in the middle of the stream of the newest ideas in education. And I've gotten to know the people who are writing and the people who are reviewing, who are a priceless resource, a lot better. It's been a lot of fun just to feel like I'm really part of that community in a way that I was not when I was just another person occasionally lobbing a paper over the fence to see what would happen to it. So it's been everything I wanted as a as an experience as an editor. The my dreams for it is I really think that that JBJS is the authoritative journal of orthopedics. And the Education Channel should similarly be the authoritative channel for research in education in orthopedics. And right now it isn't necessarily. There's just other, there's the Journal of Surgical Education, there's Academic Medicine, there are other journals that publish education pieces here and there. And so I really want to cement our role as the place you go. If you want to read about education in orthopedics, you think first and always of JBJS.
Great.
Just on that note, then, as a follow-up, George, is there a major innovation in education that you think everybody, whether you're a program director, a resident, a senior faculty, or someone just, you know, thinking about career in orthopedics should know about?
Is there a single innovation that I want
to... Well, just something from your perspective that when you think about, you know, sort of the body of work that you've already been talking about, you know, on the channel, are there things like the types of things maybe that you think are important for people to know about? So one challenge we always have is, you know, there's the core research and then there's education research, which rightly so has its absolute critical value in the things we do. Most surgeons and most residents don't really understand the advances that have been made through education, the very same things that they do. You know, we understand that the nail we're using and the indication we're using has had some prior research to get to where we are. We don't realize that the tools of educating have had the same rigor. And I wonder if there's the types of things that are typically found on the channel might be helpful for those who haven't visited it.
Well, I'm not sure how close we are to this, but I think the places where this channel or this body of research can really make a difference is where you can concretely tie how well somebody learns to how well they take care of a patient. And that's in the end, that's all that matters, right? Is how well people are cared for. And it stands to reason that people who are educated better would become better surgeons and therefore have better outcomes. But it's really hard to trace that. And so every time I review a paper, that's kind of what I'm looking for is how do I show and how do we know that teaching better makes people do better clinically?
Thanks.
What's your current view of the future of simulation, George? This is a really important part of the work that's published, but where do you think we're headed with simulation?
Well, I think simulation is, first of all, it's not new, right? We've simulated and practiced forever. Like I'm sure the cavemen, you know, like pretended to throw spears at the woolly mammoths right before they went outside and did it for real. So I'm sure. So simulation is not a new idea, and the idea that you'd be explicit in replacing a human being at risk with some simulation so that the newest learners can practice is obvious. What worries me a little bit about the simulation trend is that with all the other pressures, financial pressures and productivity pressures that are on more senior surgeons, that they it seems like some are hoping to outsource education to a machine and a simulator somewhere else, elsewhere. I don't want to have to do this and look, it's awesome. All I have to do is buy this machine and then I don't have to deal with these novices in my OR space. And I think that's a cop out and a risk. And so and you can tell that it's not going to work because of the number of simulators that have been bought and are now collecting a very expensive dust all around the hospitals. Why? Because what trainees want is to be, they want to be loved.
Right.
They want to feel that the faculty are invested in their future. Not that they've been outsourced to a mechanical babysitter to teach them instead of us. And so, maybe that's not the answer you were expecting, but I think it's actually a mix. I think that figuring out how judiciously to substitute a machine for a person at risk is critical, but we can't ever give up our sacred responsibility to teach.
I think that's really a very valuable warning to the orthopedic community. Mo, you got the last question?
So maybe this is a little bit of a tangent, but not so much. I think we started off with you talking about your career and the pride you have in being a program director. Let's say there is someone out there listening, you know, for those listening, who's contemplating, you know, that's something I want to do, but I'm not sure. What type of person broadly, George, becomes a program director? Who would you speak to if you're trying to convince someone to become a program director and take on that noble position within a residency training program?
I don't know that there's a single kind of person. I mean, like one of the great pleasures of my 10 years as program director was the fellowship of other ones in the Council of Orthopedic Residency Directors through writing together and speaking together and all of that. And of course, they run a wide spectrum of people, you know, personalities and types. And so I don't know that there's a single type. What I think they all share, and this is going to sound obvious, I hope, is just an overwhelming interest in educating younger people. You know, they're willing to sacrifice their time and their comfort and to educate. Yeah. So the salty and cynical of my friends of residency directors would say it's like a career killing move and it's a dead end job. And I found that to be very much the opposite, but it's certainly, there are other ways that you can choose to spend your time and your talents, because it's not necessarily, gonna increase the size of your practice. It's not gonna get you big grants. They're not big grants for education. I hope it's increasingly a good place to publish academically and to make a name for yourself in that way. It's definitely not the short path. But for somebody who's passionately interested in education, there's nothing else you'd rather do.
I think that's the word, right? Mm. Follow your passion.
Yeah, that's great. Well, George, thanks so much for spending the time with us this morning. And as a side comment, I want to thank you for putting on a necktie, which is endangered in orthopedic education and presentation. And my colleague Mo and I have had a recent Ortho Joe episode on this, and I appreciate the support for the endangered species.
Is it all right if I let the audience in on my secret?
Oh. Yes, please do.
For my sake, George, please tell the audience.
So the secret here is, I know this is not usually like an undressing sort of a show. Oh,
thank you.
I want to show you. All right, you ready?
Look at this. Now we're talking.
Came out of clinic.
Now we're talking.
I literally came out of clinic through shirt and tie on top of my scrubs, which is what I was wearing in the clinic.
George.
Just to gussy it up for all of you.
That is the single most.
This is my real uniform.
On any sort of meat, that's the single most honest moment on Ortho. On the Ortho Joe, single most honest moment.
I have to agree.
Having a guest undress on camera.
Love it.
I hope it never happens again.
We greatly appreciate your candor. And for this, you're going to be getting this priceless Ortho Joe mug in the mail shortly. So have a great day, George, as you return to clinic in the OR. And thanks, Mo, as always.
Oh, take care.
Great visit. Bye-bye.
Take care. Thank you.